Rose.
Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I'm so glad you hung on because the professor himself is here, the bitter ender, and he's got more education than all the rest of us together on this show. That's why we call him the professor, because he's
educated. I've been called lots of things, never a professor before. And we won't repeat some of those other names on air.
Well, I'll tell you what, that could just be considered like combat ribbons for you.
I guess.
That's for sure. Well, it's so great to have you on. I know you're one of the big people's favorites, one of the favorites of people on Blood River Radio, my favorite. And Frank White up north in the Mason-Dixon line said that the bitter ender is a national hero and a national treasure. I could not agree more. I don't know anybody that knows more about history than you do.
It's an interesting subject. I think we've got an interesting subject for our folks today. I majored in history, not English. I can't speak. But anyway, I want to wish you good luck. You're going up to the belly of the beast up in the Northeast for the New York City Marathon. So I'm sure you're going to pack 20,000 into Madison Square Garden just to see you, like the 20,000 plus that came to see President Trump last weekend. So
if they were going to burn me at the stake, I'm sure they could get probably more than that. Yeah, but you know, I was just telling the bitter ender, I was really surprised the first couple times I went up there. We meet, there's a guy named Frank White. Gene met him in Greenville. We can't discuss who he is.
Yeah.
He's
nice fella.
Yes. And there's a bunch of those. And they think the people in the South are hardcore, like, you know, neo-Nazis, Confederates or whatever. Memphrica is, I'm so ashamed almost to be from Memphrica, Gene. I'm going to make this quick because they're so watered down. There's so many self-hating, you know, crooks here. So many people that are woke.
You don't have to apologize for Memphis. Nashville is no better. And we've got Vanderbilt University here and Belmont and all these colleges that bring in all these goofy nutcase professors. And it just, you know, it's like some kind of disease that spreads all over the city.
Yes.
And, you know, and then you throw a lot of the music people in here. Some of them are pretty hardcore conservative, but then a lot of them are just flakes. And everybody comes to Nashville thinks they're going to get a recording contract as soon as they get off the bus. So, you know, Nashville used to be a nice town. It really did. And very enjoyable, very safe. But the drugs and the crime and, you don't go downtown Nashville at night. And, you know, tourists, if you go, they stay right there on Lower Broadway where they got plenty of honky-tonks and beer joints, but they got plenty of police down there. And you get away from that part of town, and you're pretty much taking the life in your own hands at night. So, obviously, they're not going to ask me to be on the Chamber of Commerce.
You know, Gene, I got a quick question about that, and I don't want to get you off your track. Do you think, I noticed when I got drafted, and I was telling people I can't wait to get back home. It's where it's safe. People drive like they've got sense. There's no dope there. My God, it was culture shock. Do you think the Vietnam messed up this country, James?
I think that generation did. You know, they talk about the greatest generation, which had been our parents' generation. They had to live through the Depression, and then they fought World War II, and then they came back, and you know the baby boomers and all this kind of stuff. Well, that generation brought the Depression on from greed and over-speculation. That generation suckered us into a war that we had no business being involved in. And then that generation raised a bunch of spoiled brats that turned out to be the drug heads and the Vietnam protesters and the hippies and just the garbage of society. So I don't think the greatest generation was very great at all in what they left us to deal with in this country. I'm sorry. I mean, that's was my dad and mother and dad and uncles and people from that generation. But, you know, what they left us was just a horrible, horrible mess. And I don't know if this country will ever recover from it.
That's a great point. I've never heard it put that way, but you know what? I never thought about that. I think you're exactly right. I really do. But because
you look at history from that generation and what happened. And, you know, my parents weren't big investors in the stock market. They never had that kind of money. And my dad didn't go rushing off the day after they bombed Pearl Harbor and running around in the street waving a Yankee flag and saying, let's go get those dirty Japs or something like that. He was drafted. And so, you know, there were a lot of people that didn't go along with that. But still, it was the so-called leadership in that generation that got us into the Depression, that got us into a war we had no business being in, cut a deal with the Russians to give them all of Eastern Europe, that, you know, turned this hippie generation loose on the country and just stood back and let them, you know, burn campuses and brought in the drug generation and all the stuff like that. And so I don't think that's much to brag about what they left us. So anyway, and like I said, not everybody was like that. My parents were very straight, honest, hardworking people. And but the leadership, I guess you'd say the leadership of that generation was the one that just really wrecked this country.
The dope. I tell you what, and I'll shut up after this. I'm notorious getting us off on these rabbit trails. But I heard about marijuana when I was in high school, but gee, until I got drafted into I know the Army was probably worse than Marine Corps in a lot of ways, because Marine Corps, I think the guys are probably more moral, and they volunteered more. They went, you know, they were more patriotic. We us draftees, man, we're so many sluggards. But I never saw dope.
I never did either.
It was so,
you know,
much
like. Like that Jimmy Buffett song, when only jazz musicians were smoking marijuana. So, no, I never had heard about it, but it was always out on the left coast, you know, or some real, or the Greenwich Village in New York or someplace like that. Most of the guys I knew would, you know, they were really hot shots that they thought if they could sneak a beer once in a while or go in an alley somewhere and smoke a regular cigarette. But that was about as wild as it ever got. So anyway, very, very sheltered childhood, I guess.
I was shocked all the dope I saw. It seemed like you were, I got to be a like hard drinker, but I didn't ever do that dope. But anyway, I hope I didn't get you too far off the chair. But
No.
I've never heard it put that way. Well, that's why you're a history guy. I mean, I've never heard. I'm not to remember that.
Just kind of looking back at it, you know, you look at history and how it affects culture, how it affects civilizations. I think, you know, I really believe the United States culture and its history and everything is in a decline, and it's an empire, and empires have a certain lifespan, and then they decline, and then they fall apart, and either the barbaric hordes come in and take over, or they usually empires collapse from the inside, and you know they have to hire mercenaries to defend the perimeter, the frontiers. Their money becomes no good. They have too many people that are willing to just sit around and let somebody else do the work for them, and you know that's pretty much where we're headed right now. And I hope next week Mr. Trump gets elected. But I think if he does, it's only going to stall the inevitable for 4 or 5 more years, and maybe if that much. I think the bureaucracy in this country is too entrenched. And they'll do everything they can to destroy him from the day he takes the oath of office till the day they try to assassinate him again. I think that's going to happen. So, you know, they see him as a threat to the established power structure in D.C. I mean, they had Kennedy killed, and they've tried twice to have Mr. Trump killed. So who's to say that they won't do it another time? And this time get a professional from the FBI or the CIA or, you know, Homeland Security or somebody like that to take him out. So I just... You know, they tried to kill George Wallace when it looked like he might win the Democratic nomination. They had that crazy guy shoot him. He's supposed to have killed Governor Wallace and just wounded him and paralyzed him. But, you know, people that upset the establishment, you got to always be looking over your shoulder. And I hope you walk around with a rearview mirror. I know Blood River Radio has upset a lot of the elitists in this country. So
I'm telling you, I thought about actually going up there and doing a broadcast program with Frank Hawaii and people like that. I said, no, they're kind of hard to round up, and I didn't want to take my equipment up there, and I was afraid it might not get there. But I think that'd been interesting broadcasting there. But I tell you what, you've opened up enough. We could do 3 hours on just what you said, Bitterender. I guarantee.
Well,
I wish we could keep doing it, but I know you got a program already ready to run.
Yeah, I thought we'd have one, something a little different we haven't done before. I don't think we've done this one before. I've given this talk to a lot of Sons of Confederate Veterans organizations, camps, or local groups. In fact, I'm going to be in Memphis later on in November and give this to the DeWitt Smith Job SCV camp there. But this is a history of the Confederate States Marine Corps. And a lot of people don't know, well, have never heard of that, and don't know that the Confederate military, the Department of the Navy, had a Marine Corps. And they don't even know some of the things they did. They had a very interesting history. And it actually, the Confederate Marine Corps covered the entire globe because Marines on sailing ships, they go wherever the ship goes, and Confederate naval ships went all over the globe. So we will pick up on that right after our break.
Yeah, once again, I would like to apologize. Gene says so many things that just makes me, it's just so interesting. You had to comment on them. So I hope I didn't throw you too far off, Bitterender. But anyway,
we'll get back.
I hope we do, because it's very interesting. Be right back, folks.
As you are aware, America is divided over every fault line possible. This is intentionally fostered by those who do not love God, family, or country. We believe a peaceful future as a free people absolutely depends on civility. Clarion Call for Civility is looking for funding and volunteers at every level to make our hopes and efforts a reality. Please donate, sign our pledge, and help us in our sacred cause. Please visit callforcivility.com for more details. callforcivility.com.
This is Michael Hill, Chief of the League of the South. I listen to Blood River Radio, and you should too. In fact, you should be telling your friends, your family, and your associates to listen to Eddie Miller and the good folks at Blood River Radio. They stand resolutely for the preservation of white civilization, what we once called Christendom, and they stand against the ongoing campaign of white genocide. In these trying and uncertain times, it's more important than ever to speak and act in defense of our God, our people, and our civilization. Blood River Radio speaks the truth and speaks it boldly. I've been on this show many times as a guest, and I'm very proud of my association with you. May our just cause prevail. Hail victory.
Introducing Managed IT Services from NPI. We offer top-notch data backup and recovery, email spam protection, and network security tailored to your needs and budget. With 20-plus years of experience in the medical field, our HIPAA-certified consultants know what it takes to protect sensitive information. Don't settle for less. Give us a call at 801-706-6980 and experience the difference with Managed IT Services. Remember, your IT support should be fast, efficient, and reliable.
Dear Blood River Radio, the Bitterender said he's going to move. They're getting ready to appoint him as the commandant of the Marine Corps. He's going to move it to the Tun Tower, I believe. That's right. The headquarters are commandant. You want to see the Bitterender, you got to go to the tower. You got to get a tall, cool one. Go ahead, Bitterender. Set me back straight, I guess.
Well, the history of the Confederate Marine Corps and the United States Marine Corps traveled the same road up until 1861. But the history and tradition of Marines, which is defined as fighting troops on board ships, goes back to a much, much earlier time. The real old core of Marines were the Phoenicians. They had armed troops on these sailing ships, and then first the Greeks and later the Romans had Marines on their war galleys. Now, the tactical mission of the early Marines was the same as it is today. Number one, they provided ship security to defend the ship from enemy attack or a boarding party, or in reverse, attack or board an enemy ship. And number two, capture and hold approaches to a harbor. And number three, enable the fleet to strike a blow on land, or the definition is a naval attack projected ashore, either by raiding parties or by an amphibious assault. And, of course, that's what all the Marine attacks were during World War II on the islands from Guadalcanal and Iwo Jima and Okinawa and all of those, Peleliu. Now, the American Marine tradition goes back directly to the Royal Marines, to the British Navy. The symbols and traditions of today's Marines are traced back to these Royal Marines, the globe and anchor, but with the Western Hemisphere for the U.S. Marines. The scarlet, and the British Marines have the Eastern Hemisphere, and the Marine emblem today has the Western Hemisphere. The scarlet and gold comes from the Royal Marines, and if you go to a Marine base today, all the signs are red with yellow or gold letters. But on our history about the Marines here, during the American Revolution, which was our first war for independence, the Southern Independence War was our second one, the Continental Marines were formed by an act of the Continental Congress on November 10th, 1775, we were kidding about during the break, at Tun Tavern in Philadelphia, which is very appropriate for the Marine Corps. Yes. They've been hitting taverns every war since then. Then along the coast of North Africa, Marines fought the Barbary pirates. This was our first war against the Muslim terrorists from 1801 to 1805. And Marines under Naval Commander Stephen Decatur captured the port of Tripoli. And Marine Lieutenant Presley O'Bannon marched overland across the Libyan desert to attack Tripoli from the less defended land side. Now, during the War of 1812, Marines were called into service again and fought at the Battle of Bladensburg, just outside Washington, D.C. And when the militia broke and ran, they called it the Bladensburg Races, the Marines held and fell back slowly into Washington. The British were so impressed by the stand that the Marines made, they spared the home of the Marine Commandant when they burned Washington, D.C., which is, wouldn't be a bad idea to do that again today. The oldest building, the Commandant's home, is the oldest building in D.C. in continuous use. And it's also home of the Marine Barracks at 8th and I Street in Washington. It's the oldest post of the Corps. And if you ever get a chance to be in Washington on a Friday night in the summer, I invite you to go see the evening parade at the Marine Barracks. It's free. You just have to call ahead and get reservations to get in there. But they have the Marine Drum and Bugle Corps, the Marine Corps Band, and then the Marine Silent Drill Team, where they do all the fancy drill and flipping the rifles up over their heads and everything. It's quite a show to see. That's on Friday nights in the summer. During the Mexican War, there were several amphibious landings in Mexico and California, and they made the final assault against the citadel of Chapultepec in Mexico City. They marched with General Winfield Scott to the National Palace, the halls of the Montezumas. And before Semper Fidelis, always faithful in Latin, became the adopted motto of the Marine Corps motto was from the shores of Tripoli to the halls of the Montezumas, which was the Marine motto, Marine Corps motto. And then the Marines hymn reversed the chronology of that and starts off from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. And it's about this time that the term leathernecks began to be applied to Marines for the high collar that was worn on the dress uniforms. And some people think that was a barrier against sword cuts, and really it wasn't. A sharp sword will cut through that leather and sever your spinal column and your throat and everything else.
It's the sword you
along
use.
With it. But it was to keep their head up straight, more a dress uniform than anything else. But with the rise of Yankee imperialism, their disregard for the Constitution, and their attacks on all things Southern, the country began to unravel in the 1850s. Abolitionist zealots in the Northeast hired the terrorist from the Kansas Territory to come east, instigate a slave uprising, and murder all white Southerners. Now, this was not an idle threat to Southerners. They remember what had happened on the island of Haiti during the uprising there, and the murder-filled rampage that the blacks took out against white women and children and chased the French colonists up into the mountains and chased them up there and just hacked them to death with machetes and axes and anything they can get. And it wasn't just the South. In the North, black codes were passed in Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio that a black could not stay overnight in those states. Or if they did, they had one night, and then they had to get out. So John Brown and his followers in 1859 attacked Harper's Ferry, Virginia. The idea was they were going to raid the army arsenal there, get all the weapons out, and give them to the slaves in Virginia and Maryland, and start this slave uprising and kill as many white Southerners as they possibly could. There were no army troops or militia available in the D.C. area or Maryland area, so the only military people with any training in that area were the Marines at the Marine Barracks in Washington. And they were sent to Harper's Ferry to put down this uprising. The commander of the army, General Winfield Scott, sent his most trusted U.S. Army officer, Colonel Robert E. Lee, with the Marines to subdue the terrorist attack at Harper's Ferry. Lee needed someone who could recognize Brown in case there were hostages, so Lee called on a young Army cavalry officer from the Kansas frontier who was home on leave in Virginia. The young officer was James Ewell Brown Stewart, and Lee asked him to go with him. And here is the irony of the expedition being sent to Harper's Ferry that night on the train. The future commander of the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia, Robert E. Lee, was there. His future cavalry commander, J.B., or Jeb Stuart, and the future assistant commandant of the Confederate States Marine Corps, and the ranking Marine officer there was Second Lieutenant Israel Green. So you had three future Confederate officers that were leading this expedition to go to Harper's Ferry. The Marines stormed the engine house and the railroad yards. Brown and his followers were driven off the streets and away from the arsenal by armed civilians of Harper's Ferry. Now, do we need to emphasize the Second Amendment here to explain why people need to have weapons just in case? After Brown and his men had shot and killed several citizens, and the first person they killed at Harper's Ferry was Hayward Shepherd, a free black man who refused to join Brown and his followers in killing his neighbors. And he was shot laying out in the street, and some of the whites were dodging and ducking and getting away from bullets that were ricocheting off the cobblestone streets. They grabbed Mr. Shepherd and drug him back behind the building to try to save his life, but it was too late. He had already received a mortal wound. Lee, in his final report, after they got rid of Brown and captured him and his followers, Lee praised the Marines in his official report, and he said, "I must also ask to express my entire commendation of the conduct of the detachment of Marines who were at all times ready and prompt in the execution of any duty." Now, Lincoln's election, with only 39% of the popular vote, mainly from the Northeast, was the last straw. South Carolina on December 20th, 1860, was the first state to leave, and then other states began to peacefully and legally leave the Union. The government of the Confederate States of America was established at Montgomery, Alabama, in February of 1861, excuse me, with the election of Jefferson Davis as president. The Confederate Congress authorized the creation of a Confederate States Marine Corps on March 16th, 1861, which is the birthday of the Confederate States Marine Corps, like November 10th is for the U.S. Marine Corps. Congress approved Davis' request and appointed Stephen Mallory of Florida as Secretary of the Navy. And Mallory had the unenviable task of creating a Navy and Marine Corps from scratch. And Congress authorized the uniform of the Confederate Marines. It's a gray shell jacket with black cuffs and collar, a gray flannel shirt, a blue kepi, you know, the cap, and blue or white trousers, depending on the weather or season of the year. Now, this is something interesting. The Confederates and U.S. Marines of that day used the inverted hunting horn with the letter M as the Marine Corps emblem. We'll continue our story after the break.
Can't wait to hear it, folks. Be right back, folks.
Protecting your liberties. You're listening to Liberty News Radio. Going to do if Kamala wins. Moving to gold now is an option. While volatility has plagued stocks and bonds for months, gold continues to reach new all-time highs, proving its worth as a safe haven asset during times of economic uncertainty. At Premier Gold, they specialize in helping those with a 401k, IRA, or other retirement accounts diversify their savings into physical precious metals like gold. By leveraging a gold IRA, you can actually invest in precious metals using your retirement funds. The transfer process is seamless, and Premier Gold makes investing easy. Right now, they're sending listeners a free gold investment kit to help you decide if this move is in your best interest. Call 606-800-8000. Discover how you could start building wealth that stands the test of time. Call 606-800-8000. Premier Gold is not a financial advisor. Please consult with your advisor before investing. Call 606-800-8000.
South Korea sounding an alarm over the growing military ties between North Korea and Russia, with North Korean troops now fighting alongside the Russians in Ukraine.
Seoul is currently weighing up how to respond, whether to send weapons to Ukraine and perhaps a team to monitor the situation on the ground. Its greatest concern is that Moscow might help Pyongyang improve its weapons program in return for this latest support. South Korea's intelligence agency believes Russia has already helped North Korea build a military spy satellite.
The BBC's Gene McKenzie in the South Korean capital. A Japanese nuclear reactor, which survived a massive 2011 earthquake and tsunami that badly damaged the nearby Fukushima nuclear power plant, has been restarted after a safety upgrade. As the Japanese government pursues a renewed expansion of nuclear energy. Breaking news and analysis at townhall.com. Lisa Dwyer reports that a Bob's Burger actor has received jail time for his role in the riot on Capitol Hill.
An actor known for his roles in the television comedies Bob's Burgers and Arrested Development has been sentenced to 1 year in prison for his part in the mob's attack on the U.S. Capitol nearly 4 years ago. Jay Johnston joined other rioters in a heave-ho push against police officers guarding a tunnel entrance to the Capitol during the January 6, 2021 riot. Johnston expressed regret for his conduct before being sentenced to 1 year and 1 day behind bars. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
The Washington Post has reportedly lost more than 200,000 subscribers following a decision announced last week not to endorse a candidate in the presidential race. The Post, with more than 2.5 million subscribers, is the country's third largest newspaper in circulation size. More on these stories at townhall.com. I'm John Scott.
Being this is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
We're at Blood River Radio. We're going to go ahead of story to tell, but we're going to go right back to the Bitter Inner because I've already sidetracked him enough. Go ahead, continue on Bitter Inner about those Marines and how they had to create a ship, a Navy from nothing with the Confederacy. I don't know how the hell they did
that. Oh, yeah.
But they had to.
Didn't have much choice. And that's one reason the Confederacy, I think, you know, could not successfully defend itself. It never had a large Navy like the U.S. had, and could the U.S. Navy could blockade our ports and just starve the South into submission. But we were talking about the emblem of both the Confederate and U.S. Marines. Back then, instead of the eagle, globe, and anchor, they had a hunting horn, you know, that has that kind of round shape to it, and then the bell. And an M in the middle of it for both the Confederates and U.S. Marines. And it wasn't until later on that they adopted the eagle, globe, and anchor. And then one thing on the Confederate and U.S. Marine uniforms of the 1800s, the chevrons were turned and pointed up like we have chevrons today. And if you look at photographs of the Army soldiers, both Union and Confederate, back during the war, the chevrons were pointed down on the sleeve. Now, that was something a little different. The commandant of the Confederate Marine Corps was Lloyd James Beale of Maryland. He'd been former Army major.
Former farmer.
He was one of those, too. He was the rank of colonel, and that was the highest rank in the Confederate Marine Corps. The assistant commandant we mentioned earlier was Israel Green. He had the rank of major. and Congress authorized 10 companies or a regiment of 1,000 men. But probably there were only about 650 to 680 officers and men that served in the Confederate States Marine Corps. Now, recruiting took place in all of the southern port cities, and one of the most successful, Eddie, was in Memphis. They recruited a whole company, 100 men of Marines out of Memphis. And training sites were set up all over at Pensacola and all the naval ports. The Marine Corps headquarters was on Broad Street in Richmond, but the heart of the Corps, the boot camp, was at Camp Beale at Drury's Bluff on the James River below Richmond. And it was a training camp for Marine officers and enlisted men. As mentioned earlier, the Marines' number one job was ship security. There was a Confederate Marine detachment on Captain Raphael Sims' first commerce raider, the Sumter. And it slipped past the blockade at the mouth of the Mississippi River, and it destroyed Yankee merchant ships all over the Caribbean and Atlantic. And then finally, they had to sail the worn-out ship to the British in Gibraltar. Well, here's the problem of the Confederate Navy. They could never come home. Once they got past the blockade, there was no way they could turn around and bring a ship that they'd captured back into a southern port, because they had to try to get through the blockade. So once these ships got out, the life of that ship was out on the ocean, and they never came home until it was sunk or the war was over. Another commerce raider was the Shenandoah, and that was built in Liverpool, England. And it was a state-of-the-art, one of the fastest ships of its day. It had three masts for sails, but it also had steam engines. And under the command of Captain James Waddell, they left England and sailed down the Atlantic, through the Indian Ocean, picked up a detachment of Marines in Melbourne, Australia, headed up across the Pacific, and attacked the U.S. whaling fleet up in the Bering Sea. You know, they used whale oil back then for lamps. And they sank 32 whaling ships in the Bering Sea. They stayed up there a little too long, and the ship got caught in the ice. And they had to get the sailors and Marines off the ship with axes and picks to chop their way out of this ice before the ice just crushed the hull of the ship, and they froze to death up in the Arctic Sea. They did make it out of there. Then they were returning back down across the Pacific. They were headed for San Francisco. They were going to raid the Presidium there at that that park right close to the Golden Gate Bridge, where the Golden Gate Bridge is today. They were going to raid San Francisco. But they stopped a British ship out on the high seas to check their papers and make sure it was a British ship and not a Yankee ship flying a British flag. And it was a British ship. But this was in 1865. And the British told them, "Well, we're sorry, mates, but your war has been over for about 2 months." And they had no idea. They hadn't seen a newspaper or CNN or Fox News or anything on board the ship. They didn't know the war was over. So what they did, they dumped all their cannons overboard so they wouldn't be considered a pirate ship, and sailed on down the west coast of America, the west coast of South America, rounded Cape Horn, came back up the Atlantic, recrossed the equator, and brought the Shenandoah into its home port at Liverpool, England, dropped anchor on the Mercy River, and surrendered the last official Confederate flag to the British on November 6, 1865. So that was the last Confederate flag that was actually surrendered from a Confederate military unit. There were no Marines on the most famous of all the Confederate commerce raiders, the Alabama, but there was a Marine officer, a Lieutenant Beckett Howell. And he was the brother of Verena Howell Davis. So he was the brother-in-law of President Jefferson Davis. There was a Marine gun crew on the CSS Virginia that fought the famous battle between the ironclad ships in Hampton Roads, Virginia, in March of 1862. Now, here's one of the ironies of history. When Stephen Mallory was a senator from Florida, he was chairman of the U.S. Senate Committee on Naval Affairs. And he wanted the United States to build ironclad ships. He knew that England and France were building ironclad ships. And he said, "Now, in the next war, we're going to have to fight ironclad ships, and we have an all-wooden Navy." Well, the Navy traditionalists rejected the idea. But he did get the Navy to agree to build six of these new steam frigates that had steam engines and sails. Now, remember the number six. As Secretary of the Navy on President Davis's cabinet, the Confederates didn't have any tradition, So they would build whatever they could. They built an iron casement over the hull of the old U.S. frigate, the Merrimack, which is in Gosport Navy Yard in Norfolk. And in only one morning, Stephen Mallory's new iron ship rammed and sank the USS Cumberland, set the USS Congress on fire, battered and ran the USS Minnesota aground. So in one morning, Stephen Mallory's ironclad ship that the United States Navy didn't want to build knocked out three of the six modern Navy ships that he had worked so hard to get built while it was in the United States Senate. The same Marines served the next day on the battle of the ironclad battle of ships between the CSS Virginia and the Monitor. So, and another irony is, after this iron casement was put over the hull of the old Merrimack in dry dock, the old line Navy traditionalists in the Confederate Navy didn't want any part of this newfangled invention if this iron ship floated like a rock and just went down to the bottom. So Marines, and I always like to point this out to the Navy, Marines had to man the bow and stern lines as it slid down the dry dock into the water at Gosport Navy Yard. The Navy didn't want to launch their ships, but the Marines had to launch it for them. They had a Marine gun crew on board the CSS Tennessee in Mobile Bay. The smaller wooden ships were driven off by Farragut and the U.S. fleet. Only the Tennessee was left to take on Farragut's fleet. The Tennessee, along with the guns at Fort Morgan and Fort Gaines, fought 19 enemy ships in a six-hour battle. And then the Marines manned the other forts around Mobile Bay. It took the U.S. over a month to finally capture the city of Mobile and close it to blockade runners. The second tactical mission of Marines provides security for naval bases. The Confederate Marines were at Gosport Navy Yard in Norfolk, New Orleans, Pensacola, at Rockets Landing Navy Yard just below Richmond on the James River. Confederate Marines from the Pensacola Squadron raided and burned the camp of the 6 New York Volunteers on Santa Rosa Island near Fort Pickens after the Yankees had looted and burned civilian homes in Pensacola. Another tactical mission of Marines were to man coastal defenses and coastal gun emplacements. The Confederate Marines received an official thanks from the Confederate Congress for the Battle of Drury's Bluff down below Richmond. They manned two of the big heavy guns up on the bluff, but the main contribution of the Marines when the United States Navy decided they were going to steam up the James River and take Richmond from the river, they provided deadly accurate fire of snipers along the riverbank, along the James River below the bluff, and they reduced the concentration and accuracy of the U.S. gunners on ships coming up the river because bullets were zipping past their ears and ricocheting off the barrels of these guns. Around Charleston, Marines served as gun crew on board the ironclads of the Charleston Squadron, such as the CSS Charleston, and served on gun crews at Fort Moultrie and in Fort Sumter. The Marine barracks at Charleston received special training. They trained boarding Yankee ironclads to throw glass jars of gunpowder wrapped in turpentine rags down the smokestack and vents of these ironclads. Now, the monitors never got close enough to try this risky plan. Marines were at Fort Fisher, which kept Wilmington, North Carolina, open for blockade runners. The Confederate Marines at Fort Fisher and Battery Buchanan on the Fear River in the Battle of February of 1865. Only battle in the war where Confederate and U.S. Marines were on the same field of battle.
I'll tell you what, Gene, you're a rolling night beater in there. I'll tell you what, we'll get right back to you as soon as we come back to this break, folks. Can't wait to hear the rest of it.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
I'm Pastor Everett Ramsey, pastor of Faith Baptist Church. A congregation of God's covenant people, informed Christians know that we are at the brink of a long-planned one-world government being executed that will not tolerate true Christian faith. There is a way to stop it. Our church has used God's spiritual weapons of warfare many times over the years, and in every case that was properly executed, the Church of Jesus Christ has been delivered. It is called the Court of Divine Justice. David used it many times. Read Psalm 37, Psalm 109. It includes truthful information, repentance, and imprecatory prayers. Blood River Radio is the only radio station I know that supports action based on truth about lies concerning the Confederacy, the Civil Rights Movement, the German people, the true Holocaust, and who the true covenant people of God are, and the sins and failures of the churches, if any of these. This means anything to you, and it should, then please say so with your money, as well as prayers. You may obtain information from us about the Courts of Divine Justice by sending your offering and request to Blood River Radio, and we take none of the money.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at cspoa.org. That's cspoa.org.
Hey, Blood River Radio family. I tell you what, Mr. Bitterender himself, he is on a roll. I'm telling you what, he is the man when it comes to this history. I was just telling him, this is an aside, if I was in his class, I would have to have not one, but probably two or three tape recorders to record off, because the recorders, they would probably start smoking to get so hot. But anyway, go ahead, Bitterender. Finish up with your, continue on with your class, brother.
We will try to get it in for the program. Another tactical mission of the Marines was to form raiding parties or make amphibious landings. The Confederate Marines planned to raid the prisoner of war camp at Point Lookout, Maryland, summer of 1864. And they had 5,000 extra rifles. They were going to harm the prisoners, but the coordination with the cavalry failed to materialize when Early's raid on Washington was delayed. And also the plan was compromised by a spy. But they did have one amphibious raid that was at least partially successful, the Marine and Navy raid on New Bern, North Carolina, in the dead of winter in January of 1865. Marines and sailors were wrapped in blankets and huddled in boats strapped to flat cars that were taken by train from Richmond down to the Neuse River, rowed down the river to New Bern, and attacked and actually captured the USS Underwriter, which is the largest U.S. gunboat in North Carolina waters. They overpowered the crew. They tried to take the ship, but the steam was so low they couldn't have it power itself. They even tried pulling it with rowboats, and that didn't work. And now they were under fire from the Yankees on shore and the fort. So they went back and set the ship on fire, and the fire went out. So they had to have some volunteers row back over to it, climb up on it, set it on fire again, and wait around until it caught fire and made sure the fire was burning before they made their escape. The Confederate Marines served in a wide variety of duty stations, and one we've talked about in our program that we give on the Marine Corps was Henry Doak. And he was born in Washington County in East Tennessee. He tried to enlist in the Mexican War. The only problem was he was 4 years old, and they thanked him very much for his patriotic endeavor, but turned him down. So the next year he had a better plan. He rode a horse to the recruiting station and tried to enlist, and they figured out it was just still a small boy on a big horse. But the third time he enlisted,
he had a little course.
Was during the War for Southern Independence. He enlisted in the 19th Tennessee Infantry Regiment. He got a battlefield promotion at Mill Springs. He was wounded at Shiloh, and while he was recuperating at home, he read about the Marines at Drury's Bluff up in Virginia and asked for and received a transfer to the Confederate States Marine Corps. Went through officer's training at Drury's Bluff, and then his first duty station was at Charleston. And he was on a gun crew of the CSS Charleston, and with the other ships of the Charleston squadron, they defeated three amphibious attacks on Charleston. Now, I'm sure a lot of our listeners already know this tonight, but the siege of Charleston, South Carolina, was the longest siege of any city in the Western Hemisphere. It lasted over 3 years, and it was brutal on the civilians. The Yankees elevated the barrel of their siege guns and fired over Confederate lines at civilian targets in Charleston. They used the spires of the churches as aiming points, and they were trying to drop these big artillery shells in on these churches because they knew that every pew in all of these churches were used as hospital beds. So if they could kill off the doctors and nurses, then they wouldn't have anybody to take care of the wounded soldiers and civilians in there. Lieutenant Doak was then transferred to, and this could possibly, what they did to Charleston could possibly be classified as America's worst terrorist attack. They had a worse death rate among, percentage-wise, among the civilian population of Charleston than they did civilians in the attack in the World Trade Centers in 9/11. So Lieutenant Doak was transferred to Wilmington, North Carolina. He served as a gun crew on board the ironclad CSS Raleigh, which actually broke the blockade at Wilmington. And then his next posting was a Marine detachment on the CSS Tallahassee, which was one of those commerce raiders. They slipped past the federal blockade and headed up to the shipping lanes between New York City and Nova Scotia. And in 3 weeks, they sank or ransomed 33 ships. Then they were headed for the Brooklyn Navy Yard. They were going to attack them there, but they were running low on coal, and they were afraid they'd get trapped and wouldn't be able to get out. But unfortunately, the spring of 1865 signaled the end of the Confederate States Marine Corps, like the rest of the Confederacy. After sinking of the Alabama off the coast of Cherbourg, France, Admiral Sims escaped capture. He was picked out of the water by an English in the English Channel by a British yacht. He returned to the Confederacy through Matamoros, Mexico, got across the Mississippi on a homemade raft, and reported to Richmond for orders. He was given command of the James River Squadron, which were the only ships left in the Confederate Navy. When the lines at Petersburg were broken and Richmond was evacuated, he sank the James River Squadron in the James River to prevent the U.S. Navy from being the first enemy in the Confederate capital. Now, part of the Marines and sailors went with Lee toward Amelia Courthouse, and part with Sims toward Danville, Virginia. The Marines and sailors fought at Sailor's Creek, where most were either killed or captured, but a few survived and surrendered with Lee at Appomattox Courthouse. And Sims, with the Naval and Marine Detachment, turned south toward North Carolina when they learned of Lee's surrender. Marines from Wilmington, who had defended the city after the fall of Fort Fisher, and the Marines under Admiral Sims served under Joseph E. Johnston and fought at the Battle of Bentonville in North Carolina in March of 1865. And those Marines and ones under Admiral Sims surrendered with Johnston at the Bennett Farmhouse in April of 1865. Marines surrendered at the Charlotte Naval Ordnance Department, the Augusta Powder Works, and the defensive positions at the northern end of Mobile Bay. There was a Marine escort with President Davis after he evacuated Richmond, and the Marines were sent away with part of the Confederate Treasury to pay Davis's escort and with Davis's personal papers. And that ends the tragic and all too brief history of the Confederate States of America and her Marine Corps. Rebel Leathernecks had served from the Bering Sea to Gibraltar on land from New Orleans to the James River. And the Confederate Marine Corps had ended, but not the spirit of Confederates in the Marine Corps. So I hope our audience has learned a little bit about an interesting branch of the Confederate military, something that's not very well known, but a branch that had a very varied and unique history, serving, as we said, all over the globe and up and down the Gulf Coast and the Atlantic Coast. So, Eddie, I hope our listeners got something out of that tonight.
I bet you, I can tell you with full confidence they did. I most certainly did. Like I was telling Gene during one of the breaks, I never knew, you know, when you think about Lincoln's War, but, you know, the Lincoln's War, I never think about Marines being involved in it.
They didn't fight in big battles like Gettysburg or Chickamauga or anything like that, but they fought in battles, you know, pretty much every port city up and down the Atlantic coast and the Gulf Coast. There were Marines manning the coastal forts or coastal defensive positions. So they took on the United States Navy at all of these cities, at Savannah and Charleston, Wilmington, Pensacola, Mobile. So, yeah, they were in the fighting on anywhere around the coast that where there was a naval station or a naval port. And the whole point of it was to try to keep the ports open for blockade runners to slip in and out of. They would have these big heavy guns in these forts, and keep the blockade squadron out away from the actual channels into the harbor. And so at night, the blockade runners could slip in and bring in food supplies or weapons from England and then pick up cotton in the reverse and then take the cotton out the next night or two or three nights later, slip out and try to make their way past the blockade squadron. And the interesting thing about the blockade runners, they wouldn't go all the way to England. The ones from the Gulf Coast would meet the British agents in British ships in Havana, and the ones on the East Coast would meet the British agents in either Nassau or Bermuda. And they said that when these blockade ships would pull into these ports, you could see British ships all along the horizon waiting for these blockade runners to come so they could bid on this load of cotton, because they couldn't get enough cotton in England to keep the mills running. And it was very profitable. And they said that if you were a blockade runner, if you made two trips, you could make enough money to pay for your ship. So anything after that was strictly profit. So they are. But then as more and more ports were taken over by the Federal Navy or the Federal land troops, it was harder and harder to get these blockade runners into a southern port. And the Confederate Navy, I counted it up one time, the Confederate Navy built 26 ironclad ships during the four-year history of the war. And there was only one of those ironclad ships that was defeated by the U.S. Navy, and that was the poor old Tennessee down there at Mobile Bay.
Man.
It got attacked by 19 warships, so it was 19-1. And finally, they shot the why they designed it this way, I don't know, but they ran chains across the deck to the stern to turn the rudder. And once those chains were shot away under this bombardment from the U.S. ships, they couldn't turn the ship. So the Farragut and the Yankee ships just circled around it and around it and around it and just kept pounding it till it was pretty much shot to pieces and had to surrender. But all the other ships that the Confederates built, the blockade runners, were blown up by the Confederates, because the Federal Navy couldn't defeat them. But when an army was closing in on Charleston or Norfolk or Savannah from the land side, they had to pack their ship full of gunpowder, set it on fire, and blow it up so the Yankees couldn't take over their ship. And they told a story about this. In Savannah, they had some of the young ladies of the town came out to give them a tour of the ship, and these officers were very proud to show off the ironclad ship of the Confederate Navy. And one of these young girls asked him, said, "Now, where'd he put the gunpowder to blow it up?" she knew what was going to happen to the ship if the Yankees closed in on Savannah from the land side. The poor old Confederates are going to have to blow up their ship that they were so proud of. So, anyway, I don't know if she ever got invited back for a tour of the ship again or not.
Yeah, that was kind of a slight right there, you might say.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it's kind of like... kind of like asking somebody, "Well, what are you going to make your white flag out of? Is silk or cotton?"
Same thing. Yeah. What kind of material are you going to use for that? Who's going to sew that one up for you? So, but anyway, I thought it was an interesting subject. And having been in the Marine Corps, it was something I was interested in and doing a lot of the research. And, you know, there are not a whole lot of books on the Confederate States Marine Corps, but there are a few out there to give the history of it. And that Lieutenant Doak is buried in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Nashville. And he came back to Nashville after the war and married a young lady from Clarksville and became editor and publisher of the Nashville American, which newspaper, which later became the Nashville Banner, which was our only conservative paper in Nashville until they got rid of that. And then we have of course, now we got the Tennessean, which is Pravda on the Cumberland. That's just liberal garbage. We stopped taking that rag a long time ago.
Amen.
So anyway.
You did a marvelous job, Gene. I tell you, I'm sure they thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm sure our family thoroughly enjoyed it. I know I certainly did. Well, I'm glad you tuned in. Like I said, this is a pre-recorded show, and I really hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and I'll be back live before you know it. And so God bless you. Thank you, Gene, for coming in. Thank you, Monica and Paul, and thank you, Ben and Scott, for coming on early. And thank you, Miss Lizzie, for running and doing a flawless job like you always do. God bless you, dear. I'll see y'all, everybody.